Somewhere in North Carolina, heading north on I-95, well above the speed limit. Suddenly, the rearview mirror lit up with a North Carolina trooper right behind me. I pulled over. The trooper approached my window cautiously. He got to the window and clearly, carefully, and professionally checked us out. He asked if we knew how fast we were going and what was the rush. I identified myself as an FBI agent and said we were headed to D.C. He took one step back from the window, pointed north on I-95, and said, "Go get him."
Lieutenant Joseph Tarillo, Director of Fire Education Safety, FDNY. 8 hours later, I woke up and I didn't know where I was. I realized I was on the 8th floor of the hospital, in a room, but I didn't immediately know because I couldn't see. I'm like, I don't know if I'm dead or alive. That night, they found my car behind the firehouse. I was declared dead that night.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. The day had passed. I don't even know what I did. I know I walked around. I talked to some people. We did a little search. In fact, we found a police officer on West Street. He was dead. He was buried. We helped out where we could and the day passed. I hitched a ride with one of the fire engines that was going north. I think there was about 40 of us hanging off this fire engine. They dropped me off on 3rd Avenue and 29th Street and I walked down the block. I walked into the firehouse and I remember my girlfriend, Christine, was there. A number of the wives were there and some of the firemen were there. That's when I found out that Ladder 7 was missing. That's our company that's quartered with us, 16 and 7. Everybody from 7 was missing. They all died.
Chris Mullen, firefighter, Ladder 1, FDNY. It was a depressed, dismal, miserable mood. Hundreds of firefighters, thousands of civilians are gone as quickly as you blow out a match. Gone.
Captain Jay Jonas. I ended up walking from the World Trade Center to the firehouse on Canal Street. It was pretty quiet. I'm walking with all my gear on. I must have looked like Pigpen from the Charlie Brown cartoon with this big cloud of dust following me. A bunch of Chinese people from the community start following me. And somebody broke off and came and talked to me. He says, "Are you okay?" I said, "Yeah. If I keep walking, I'm okay." I says, "If I stop, I'm not going to want to start up again." Then they followed me to make sure I got to the firehouse.
Tracy Donahue, Transit Officer, NYPD. When I went home that night, I went home to my mother and sat in the backyard. It was another beautiful day. I was sitting in the backyard saying to my mother, "I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I want to stay on this job." I got up the next day and went to work. I went back the day after that and the day after that, and I said, "I'll take it day after day and see how I feel." Over time, I was okay.
Pasquale Bazzelli. I was basically in a stretcher at St. Vincent's, and they were moving me from room to room, taking x-rays and things. My friend Phil showed up. They gave me some clothes to wear because they had to rip the clothes off of me that I had on. It was Disney or Mickey Mouse, something that didn't fit. I put that on. There was a police officer there with a van, and he said, "Where do you want to go?" We gave him the address, our other friend's house. When I got to my friend's apartment, it was the first time I was actually able to watch it on television. I couldn't believe that I actually survived. Got in the car, we headed north and went across the Tappan Zee Bridge, and I was home at 8 o'clock that night. I pulled up at home with all my family and friends there. It was nice. It was nice to be home, to see my mother and father. My wife, Louise.
Louise Bazzelli. I remember the first thing when we finally got him inside the house. My mother-in-law, she's from Italy. Her first thing was, "You must be hungry." She said, "Sit down. I want to make you a nice sandwich."
As the evacuation of people from Lower Manhattan slowed, the boats that had been busy all day shuttling people out of New York reversed their journey for a new mission. Shuttling relief supplies and rescuers to Lower Manhattan.
Lieutenant Michael Day. We started getting calls that supplies were coming into Jersey and all the bridges were shut down into Manhattan. They said, hey, can we get someone to pick up some supplies? I asked if anyone would mind going over to New Jersey and picking up some supplies, and I was inundated. Sure, I'll do it. I'll do it. I'll do it. Firefighters would come up and say, we're going to need water. We don't have any water. We'd call over to someone from New Jersey. We established a dialogue with the Office of Emergency Management over there. People were going to store shelves and buying water. It was coming over. There was a lot of stuff coming over, a lot of ice. A lot of restaurants were sending meals. It was very disorganized as far as what was coming. As we started meeting those needs, we started getting more and more requests. We need acetylene for steel. We need oxygen. We need wrenches. We started making requests and things started coming. It was busy throughout that night.
At Ground Zero, firefighters and rescue personnel continued to swarm over the wreckage, looking for survivors. These efforts remained haphazard, filled by an army of volunteers, many of whom had no official rescue duties. Indeed, it was two U.S. Marines, Jason Thomas and Dave Carnes, who had traveled to the site on their own volition, who made the evening's sole incredible discovery.
Scott Strauss, officer, Emergency Service Unit, Truck 1, NYPD. We're all itching to get back in there and find civilians, find our friends, find somebody. Sergeant Timothy Adrat grabbed a bunch of us and we started searching, because they wouldn't allow us back into the pile yet. We started searching the south side, the buildings on the south side of Liberty that were damaged by the collapses, but not completely collapsed. The pile of debris was massive.
Detective Steven Stefanakos, we went to work trying to get to any voids that we could, trying to, from that moment, start any types of rescue and recovery that we could. It was pretty well established as nightfall started. William Jimeno, it was around 8 o'clock that night when I heard two voices in the distance. I heard, United States Marine Corps, can anybody hear us? I couldn't believe it that I heard voices again. I started yelling as loud as I could, PAPD officers down, PAPD officers down. They kept saying, keep yelling, we hear you. They made their way over and I could hear three individuals. They said, who's down there? I said, Port Authority Police, Officer Jimeno, my sergeant's down. We have men down here. We have men who have died. And they said, hold on, buddy.
Scott Strauss. A firefighter comes over to us. He says, hey, I got a couple of guys that are hurt on the other side. So we started running over in that direction. We're climbing over this twisted steel. Some were very, very hot, jumping from one to the other. We're slipping on the dust. It was a very treacherous trek. Through the dust and through the smoke, I saw a guy waving a flashlight. I went over to him. I said, what do you got? He goes, you got two guys, two cops down in this hole. So I look, and there's this hole a little bit bigger than the size of a manhole. I dropped down into it, about 6 to 8 feet. It was like a very, very tiny closet. Patty McGee, an emergency service police officer with me, also jumped in the hole, as did this civilian, Chuck Sareka, a former paramedic.
William Jimeno, Truck 1 came up. They hooked up with another civilian named Chuck Sareka, a paramedic.
Patty McGee, Officer, Emergency Service Unit, Truck 1, NYPD. The race was on.
Scott Strauss. We came down on an angle about 20 to 30 feet, crawling headfirst around I-beams, through these tiny crevices, pulling ourselves through. We got down to this little open area and we turned left and we came upon Dominic Pizzullo. About 10 feet back was Will Jimeno. The only thing we could see of Will was his head, his right arm, and part of his right side. The rest of it, it looked like he was poured out of a dump truck.
William Jimeno. He said, what's your name? And I said, Jimeno. He goes, Scott Strauss, NYPD ESU Truck 1. I said, Jimeno, bus terminal, Port Authority Police. And he said, listen, you gotta hold on. You can't give up now.
Scott Strauss, I crawled in, and I had to crawl in on my side and with my hands above my head. I was crawling in, pulling myself in, and I was literally using my hands to scratch away at the rubble. As I free up some debris, I'm pushing it down along my chest to get it back out to Patty and Chuck. And they took it and were throwing it down the elevator shaft, digging their way out.
William Jimeno, They could barely move in there. All I could see was their bald heads.
Scott Strauss, we were dry heaving. We were choking on the smoke. The firemen were yelling from up above us, "Get out of there." Will says, "You're not leaving me, are you?" I go, "No, we're not leaving you, Will." Did I want to go? You better believe I wanted to get out of there. But I couldn't. It had nothing to do with any macho stuff. It had to do with self-preservation. I don't think I could have left him, gone home to my kids, and known I left him there to die. So the three of us, Chuck, Patty, and I, stayed.
William Jimeno. For the next 3 hours, they worked on me, and it was very, very painful. They were able to free my right leg, and then it took a long time for them to try to get me from under this wall.
Scott Strauss. Chuck, Patty, and I, we were exhausted. We were incredibly tired. We were in a bad way, in a bad environment.
William Jimeno. I remember saying, "I have a partner, he's here." And they thought it was Dominic. Sergeant McLaughlin kept quiet back there. I think what happened was that when they first started on me, I yelled once really hard when they touched my leg. It was really painful. I saw that Scott backed away. I remember thinking to myself, "You need to shut up and eat the pain," and that's what I did. I think Sergeant McLaughlin heard that as not to disrupt these guys. The best thing to do is to try to get us out of here faster.
Scott Strauss. All the time, Will is talking about his partner. We don't know. The only person that's talking to us in this hole is Will. Dominic Pizzullo's dead. Will's talking about his partner. "You've got to get to my partner first. You got to get him out." I'm like, "He doesn't know he's dead." Thinking he is Dominic.
William Jimeno. It was a nightmare that night.
Scott Strauss. He's like, "Hurry up, hurry. You've got to get to him. He's going to die if you don't get to him." I said, "Will, we got to do our job. We got to get you out, and then we'll get him out." We're scratching away, and then we hear Sergeant McLaughlin's voice. And he goes, "Hey, how you guys doing?" I'm like, "Who's that?" Will's like, "That's my partner." Like, "You idiots. What do you think I've been talking about?" So we're like, "We thought he was your partner." He said, "No, that's Dominic. He's dead." I'm like, "Oh my God." Now we have another rescue that we have to do.
Detective Steven Stefanakos. The two rescue sites started for the two Port Authority police officers that were trapped. Truck One guys from their team were working on that extrication. The rest of us walked around to any particular area where you might find a void that you could crawl into. Every single building in a perfect square around the Trade Center was completely demolished or damaged. The buildings were on fire still. You looked up and you said, "At any given time, any one of these buildings could fall."
Scott Strauss. Will's screaming in pain, and Sergeant McLaughlin is fading in and out this whole time. We're talking to McLaughlin, and Paddy McGee can't get any more Irish than him. He was born on St. Patrick's Day. He's in the police department pipe band. And John McLaughlin, another Irishman, and Paddy's like, "Hey, Irish eyes, are you still with us?" Sometimes he would answer, sometimes he wouldn't. When he didn't answer, Will would get worked up. "John, Sarge. Come on, Sarge. Hold on, Sarge." Then you'd hear him in a groggy voice say, "I'm here. I'm here."
William Jimeno. They were able to put me on a gurney, and I remember telling the Sarge, "Hold on, Sarge."
Scott Strauss. We get him onto the Stokes basket, and we send him out, up topside.
William Jimeno. As they started pulling me out on the gurney up this hole, I remember looking around and I said, "Where is everything?" Because I could see the moon and I could see smoke, but I couldn't see the buildings. That's when a firefighter said, "It's all gone, kid." That's the first time I cried that evening.
Omar Lyon, officer, NYPD. We heard people, some excitement. Coming up the line was a basket with a body in it, one of the Port Authority officers they rescued. We pulled him out. It was exciting, a great moment. All day you've been there and there was nothing.
Scott Strauss. I crawl back down this hole. I'm physically shot. It's now like 11 o'clock at night, 11:30 at night. John, I can't do anymore. They're sending a fresh team in. You'll be fine. These guys are going to get you out. He's like, thanks, Scott. I appreciate it. I'll see you up top. I said, absolutely. Another emergency cop, Steve Clifford, comes in the hole. And I don't know why I said this to him, but I stopped him and I go, Steve, personal friend, make sure you get him out.
William Jimeno. My sergeant came out the next day at 7 a.m.
Scott Strauss. The rescue workers, cops, firemen from all over the place. All of Nassau County, Connecticut, New Jersey, everywhere. Con Ed workers, construction workers are lining this path. And they're helping me get down, helping the three of us get down.
William Jimeno. I remember as we got to the hospital, I'm thinking there's going to be thousands of people in there. That's the second time I cried. As they pulled me off the ambulance, I see these doctors standing around and nurses. I said, where is everybody? They're like, you're it. They're telling me there's nobody else.
I wondered, did they get out? The day ends. As night descended on a country transformed and the calendar flipped from 9/11 to 9/12, lawmakers, first responders, government officials, and stricken families tried to make sense of the day they'd just experienced. Fear and uncertainty permeated everything. And across the country, many faced a sleepless night. In Washington, the fires at the Pentagon illuminated the night sky, an ominous sign of a nation newly at war.
Jackie McGuire, Special Agent, FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, New York. That night, we started to relocate and put our command center up in an automobile and maintenance garage. It was well organized. It was amazing. They emptied all the cars out and the technical people set up the phone lines. Within the next day or two, we had a full-blown, fully operational command post. We identified the hijackers pretty quickly. Then they made the case squad. They made what was known as the Pent Bomb Team. The FBI's code name for terrorism cases usually ended with bomb, B-O-M. The first trade center was Trade Bomb. The East Africa Embassy cases were Ken Bomb for Kenya and Tan Bomb for Tanzania. So they formed the Pent Bomb Team.
Keith Custer, firefighter, Shanksville Volunteer Fire Company. Later on that night in Shanksville, we got called back for numerous brush fires. You couldn't put the fire out because the ground was so saturated with jet fuel. You'd put out as much as you could, and then it would burn underground for a while, and then it would spring up somewhere else.
Lawrence Kesterson, staff photographer, Philadelphia Inquirer. I felt so removed from everything else. They kept talking on the news about something happening in Shanksville or Western Pennsylvania. No one was getting the name right the first day. Clearly, everybody was focused on New York. In the evening, I stayed at a Holiday Inn in Johnstown. I watched the TV. They were all reporting from New York. We were so fearful as to what was going to happen. I really wanted to get home to my family.
Peter M. Mike Drewecki, photographer, WPXI-TV, Pittsburgh. I think I slept an hour. I turned on CNN, and I remember there was a doctor who was outside the trade centers when they went down. CNN was running the videos of people actually jumping out of the windows, and after what I saw, I couldn't sleep. Who could? It was to the point where you were so agitated, you were so strung out on what you went through, that sleep wasn't an option.
Bruno Dellinger. When I got home, the first thing I did was take my suit off, and don't ask me why. I think it may be unconsciously because I thought there might be some human remains in those ashes. I collected them, put them into a small box. I was never able to wear that suit again, or the tie, or the shoes. For some reason, I was inspired to collect that dust and keep it. And I still have it, in a small box, with the only thing that's left of my office, a set of keys.
Brian Pearl, resident Greenpoint, Brooklyn. That night, a bunch of our friends got together at Enid's, a popular bar in the neighborhood. It felt good to be amongst friends, if for no other reason than to remind me that I wasn't the only person who had no idea what to think, feel, or do.
Richard Grasso. I was having dinner on the Upper East Side at the only restaurant that was open. What sticks in my mind was on 2nd Avenue and 75th Street were these enormous dump trucks that were heading south. You knew where they were going. I got back in my truck about 10:30, and I'll never forget it. The city was so empty.
Rick Schoenlang, President, United New Jersey Sandy Hook Pilots Benevolent Association. Probably around 11 or 12 o'clock, myself and 7 or 8 other pilots decided to go and see it for ourselves. We got off the boat, and we walked through the dust, like 6 inches of dust, that was covering everything. There were bulldozers slapping chains on the wrecks of fire trucks, police cars, ambulances just dragging them down the street. You couldn't even tell what they were anymore. There were searchlights centered on the pile. There were hundreds of people crawling all over it. Looking around on the perimeter of the whole site, it looked like a giant animal had taken a giant claw and taken swipes out of all the buildings. There were chunks of the buildings missing. All the windows were broken. Drapes and papers were flying around in the air. Fire and flame was coming out of some of the windows. It was a scene of total destruction.
Lieutenant Michael Day. I walked into Ground Zero, and I could remember there were body parts everywhere. I remember thinking, this is a war. I looked down and saw a foot in a shoe. I was fixating on it for a few minutes. It was like a siege. Looking around and seeing National Guard guys with M16s going through the streets of Manhattan. All the power was out around the area, and a lot of other buildings were on fire. And there was this eerie, gray-like snow everywhere.
Rick Schoenlang. I was standing there, and I noticed after a while, there was a very tall guy standing right next to me, and with a full particle mask on. I looked at him once, and I looked at him twice. And I said, Governor, is that you? It was Governor Pataki. Just happened to be standing right there.
Chuck Cake, firefighter and EMT, Arlington County Fire Department. Around 1 a.m., the fire was still burning on the Pentagon roof. You could see it glowing. It was decided to suspend operations until morning and then try again.
Sergeant Anthony Lisi, Emergency Service Unit, Truck 6, NYPD. By the end of the night, we were exhausted. It was about 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and our vehicle that we had driven had been destroyed. NYPD boats picked us up to take us back to Truck 6, which is in Bay Ridge. As we were driving up with the boat, there was cars waiting for us with their lights on. A guy standing by each vehicle. It was amazing. They knew what we went through, and they were waiting for us to take us back to the truck, take us home.
Jared Coates. In the middle of the night, or maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, I was awakened by a loud clap of thunder followed by a brief rainstorm. At that moment, I realized it wasn't a dream, that I certainly have lived through an incredible day. First thing, my thoughts turned to my colleagues, and I wondered, did they get out? I didn't know.
Sonny Mindell. I came home at 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, to shower. I got into my apartment and stood at the threshold and thought, what do I do with my clothes? I don't know what's on my clothes. I got a plastic bag to put my clothes in. I had to go back to work, obviously, very shortly after. All I wanted to do was shower, lay down for a few minutes. I fell asleep. And as I did, I felt like the buildings were in my nose. There was all this cement. And I woke up screaming, having a nightmare, hearing the sounds in this dream.
Tom Brokaw, anchor, NBC News. I got home at 2 a.m., sat down, and was staring out the window. I had a big, stiff drink of scotch. I was curiously contained and controlled. I was doing this out-of-body examination and asking myself, why am I not melting down? I had a second drink. I went to sleep. I slept for 4 hours. I felt rested. Then a phone call came. A very close friend of mine died of congestive heart failure the night before. It released something in me. For half an hour, all the emotion I'd bottled up came out. I sobbed.
Mike Walter. The last interview I did on 9/11 was with a colleague of mine, Lance, the photographer who was shooting for me that day. He said, "Let me turn the camera on you as a friend, talk to you about what we saw." We did the interview, and he said, "Is there anything else you want to say?" My response was, "I'm so thankful this day is over." Lance started laughing. He's like, "Mike, this isn't over. This will never be over for you. There will always be the 6-month anniversary, the 1-year anniversary, the 5-year anniversary, the 10-year anniversary. You'll be talking about this for the rest of your life."
Beverly Eckert, wife of Sean Rooney, VP of Risk Management, Aon Corporation, South Tower, 98th floor. "We met when we were only 16 at a high school dance. When he died, we were 50. I remember how I didn't want that day to end, terrible as it was. I didn't want to go to sleep because as long as I was awake, it was still a day that I shared with Sean. He kissed me goodbye before leaving for work. I could still say that was just a little while ago. That was only this morning."
Epilogue. Wednesday. As September 12th began, the entire nation tried to make sense of the previous day's attacks and the tragic losses. At the Pentagon, the fires from 9/11 had flared up and again threatened the building. All told, thousands of Pentagon workers had been displaced, and more than 2 million square feet of office space, the equivalent of the entire Empire State Building, had been damaged.
"Lieutenant Colonel Ted Anderson. I slept for a couple of hours, woke up, and thought it was all a bad dream. I popped on the news, and of course, I couldn't get away from the story. This was about 2 a.m, and I decided to get up and go to work. Put on my battle dress uniform, my fatigues, and my boots. I got in a car and drove, and as soon as I turned onto 395, I could see the orange glow in the distance. I remember very distinctly at about 3:10 a.m, parking my car, seeing this building on fire and people going into work. 10,000 people showed up to work at the Pentagon that morning. It made me extremely proud."
"Lieutenant Commander David Tarantino, physician, U.S. Navy. We all went back to work the next day in a building that was still burning to start planning our nation's response."
William Haynes, General Counsel, Department of Defense. "I remember driving in at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock the next morning, seeing a soldier on a street corner in downtown D.C. and thinking, this is something."
Mike Walter. "Washington, D.C. is such a beautiful, magnificent city. And here were all these people with weapons, the National Guards out there in their vehicles. Seemed like you were in a banana republic."
Admiral Edmund Giambastiani. "We started planning on the 12th of September. We knew we would get into some kind of global war on terrorism. At that time, the casualty estimates coming from New York City were that we had lost 6,000 people in the World Trade Center, more than we had lost anywhere at any time in the history of this country on any one day."
Robert Hunter. "It was about 10 a.m., and they were towing cars away from South Parking. There wasn't a lot, maybe 60 of them. None of them had moved since the previous day. It dawned on me that this guy was parking next to me yesterday, and he was never going to get in that car again. He was never going to drive home."
Scott Coker, contractor, SAIC, Pentagon. "The corridor smelled horrible, especially the upper levels. It wasn't too bad once we got back down into the basement. The Army Operations Center, where I worked, ironically was in danger of flooding because they were pouring so much water onto the fire."
Chuck Cake, firefighter and EMT, Arlington County Fire Department. "I remember working on the roof all day. Tactic after tactic after tactic. It was a poured cement building, but it's got a wooden sheathed roof on top, and the fire was under the roof. You do a trench cut to put it here, then turn around, and it had gotten under you while you were doing the trench cut. We chased it for half the day, and finally, we got it at about 2:30 in the afternoon.
Across the country, those whose lives intersected with the attacks experienced a wide mix of emotions as they came to understand the full impact, both personal and global, of what had occurred.
Lisbeth Glick. The morning after Jeremy had died, I remember looking down at our daughter Emerson. She was sleeping and just crying because she would never know her father. I thought she would only know a sad mom. We had trouble having her. It took us 2.5 years. And then to have everything taken away. We had dreams for our family. Then something just kind of clicked in my head, and I said, you know, I have a choice. I'm not going to ruin her life. I'm not going to ruin my own life.
The ticket agent at Washington Dulles Airport, who had checked in the 9/11 hijackers there and made sure they made it safely aboard American Airlines Flight 77, arrived at work the following day, oblivious to his role.
Von Alex, ticket agent, Washington Dulles International Airport, Virginia. I didn't know what I had done. I came to work and people wouldn't look at me in the eye. They handed me the manifest for the flight. I stared at it for a second, then I looked up and said, I did it. I had checked in a family. It was a retiree and his wife. I had time to talk to them. There was a student group. I checked in a lot of those kids, parents, teachers. They were all gone. Once it became known, people didn't talk to me.
For Susanna Harada, whose baby, Dylan, had been born in Arlington on 9/11, amid the chaos and the injured from the Pentagon, the happiness of her own time in the hospital contrasted with the experience of everyone around her.
Susanna Harada. Neighbors kept on coming by, and some of them I didn't know well enough to have them see me half-naked trying to nurse a baby and in pain. They said, oh, we wanted to see something good. It's wonderful how this birth was able to be a blessing to so many people, but to me it was like, get these people out of here. One neighbor came by when the nurse was trying to get me out of bed, and oh my gosh, I was sobbing. The neighbors were so excited to see Dylan and to have something great happen.
Mary Detloff, communications staff, Michigan Legislature. My partner and I made an effort to patronize our favorite Middle Eastern restaurant a day after the attack because we feared people would retaliate against it. They had put a sign on their front door saying how sorry they were about the terrorist attack and that they didn't support it. I remember thinking how sad that they felt the need to do that.
Gabriela Daya Dominguez. My father is Arabic. I remember feeling a sense of dread that week. I couldn't eat at all. Food tasted like paper. It was hard to put something in my mouth. I felt that there was going to be a backlash against Arabs. I remember being terrified.
Stacy Taylor Parham, Air Traffic Control Specialist, Cleveland Air Route Traffic Control Center. I remember sitting outside with my kids and how quiet it was. You don't realize how many airplanes you hear and see. They're such a part of the landscape. Sitting outside, the weather was beautiful for those next few days too. Looking up in the sky, not seeing any airplanes at all. It was so quiet.
Susanna Harada. At night, I would sit there, and Dylan would wake up. And as I'd feed him, I'd listen to the sound of the jets circling and protecting the airspace. I would lay awake and listen to that sound of the fighter planes overhead.
In New York, at what workers and rescuers called the pile, teams searched for the dead and the living, and bucket brigades began sorting and clearing debris, a process that would ultimately encompass 1.8 million tons of wreckage and stretch until May 30th, 2002. Early on the second day, rescuers stumbled upon Pasquale Buzzelli's co-worker, Janelle Guzman.
Paul Soman, firefighter, Rescue 2, FDNY. That morning we came back and we were under the command of Lieutenant Larry Gray, a really senior veteran of the New York City Fire Department, someone we would call a salty guy. We went back down to the site. The decision was made. We were going to go where Jay Jonas, his guys, and Mickey Cross survived. We said, maybe somebody else survived there.
Janelle Guzman. Everybody in my family was in mourning already. They were up all night. They didn't even entertain the thought that I had made it after the collapse. They went through a moment of thinking I was dead and they were not going to see me again. And, as the Bible says, sadness comes at night, but joy comes in the morning. That's what happened to my family. They were sad at night, and the joy waited until the morning.
Paul Soman. We started climbing up. It was a crazy climb. Everything was on fire. The steel was all hot. We got to about the 15th floor of the building, where we knew that Jonas and those guys survived, and we started to search. First, we found a couple of firemen dead. We did not take the time at that point to try to extricate them because we were looking for people who were alive. There was an elevator shaft up there, and at that point I started yelling in the elevator shaft, and I heard someone answer me back. I yelled again. I realized that we found somebody.
Janelle Guzman. They came up to that area on the heap of rubble because they saw a reflector jacket there, thinking it could be one of theirs. That's when I called out because I heard them.
Paul Soman. We got everybody quiet. We tried to pinpoint her voice. Billy Esposito and I climbed down two more floors and realized her voice was getting fainter. We couldn't hear it anymore. We started to climb up and up and up. Suddenly I could hear her a lot better. She said, "Don't leave me. Don't leave me." I assured her, "I'm not going to leave you." At that point, I said, "Tell me your name." She said, "My name is Janelle." We were literally standing on top of her, but we couldn't find her. I said to her, "Can you stick your hand or anything out?" Out of the rubble came her hand. Immediately, I grabbed it. Now we had her. Everyone was fired up. This was what we were waiting for. Everybody was exhilarated.
Janelle Guzman. Someone grabbed my hand. They called me by my name and said, "Janelle, I got you. My name is Paul." The person had my hand, and I knew I was not dreaming.
Paul Soman. I basically held her hand. We started talking back and forth. The guys went underneath her. They went over the top of her. It took about 45 minutes, and they got her out.
Janelle Guzman. I got into the ambulance with a guy, and he said, "We're going to take you to the hospital now, okay? You're going to be fine." I made it to the hospital. I asked the nurse, "Am I going to go home now?" She said, "Oh no, honey, you're going to be here for a while." Then someone said, "Do you know how long you've been there?" I said, "I don't." They said, "You've been buried for 27 hours. She said, "Do you know that you were the last survivor that they pulled out?"
Paul Soman. Away she went. In our minds, we're thinking, now we're going to start finding other people. We started to climb out onto the pile and we started finding more dead firemen. As it would turn out, she was the last survivor of the World Trade Center.
Janelle Guzman. I was praying for 27 hours. Being the last survivor, it was a huge thing. I felt totally different. When I came out of that rubble, I felt a total conviction. From there, I knew that the Holy Spirit was working in me and had changed my life. Since that day, I've been serving the Lord. After I came out of the hospital in November, I went to the Brooklyn Tabernacle Church. I got baptized. I got married to my boyfriend. I've been living the Christian life since. I had two kids after that marriage, and the Lord has been good to me.
Paul Soman, I guess it was a miracle. You think about that site that she was found. it is a miracle. It's a miracle that we climbed up there.
For the families and friends of those who were lost, 9/12 began an often long, always heartsick search for word of the missing. By Wednesday's end, the official death toll at the World Trade Center would stand at 82. But officials warned, the death toll from the nation's deadliest terrorism attack is expected to rise considerably. Not knowing the true number, New York City asked the federal government for 5,000 body bags.
Herb Ueda, World Trade Center's Association, North Tower, 77th floor, and father of Todd Ueda, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower, 105th floor. We took his picture. I went to the hospitals. It was so terrible, all of us putting up pictures. None of us could accept the scope of the tragedy. The next day, my wife said to me, "There's no hope." I said, "You're wrong." We went to a meeting of all the Cantor families. I remember Howard Lutnick, the head of Cantor, telling us there was no hope. People were so angry at him for saying that. He was telling the truth. We waited, we prayed. Eventually, we accepted it.
Heather Ordover. The hardest was the next day. The rumors had been flying that my principal's sister was at Cantor Fitzgerald on the 105th floor. She was missing, presumed dead. But all the children were home and accounted for.
John Napolitano. We went back to the site every day. I knew a lot of the firemen down there. They had all grown up with my son, so we had no problem getting in. He was never found. Every day I'd go home and wish I could tell my wife something good. Never happened. I had no good news for them.
Lieutenant Joseph Tarillo, Director of Fire Education Safety, FDNY. Firefighters from the Jersey City Fire Department came to the Jersey City Trauma Center, where I was, and they actually took me back to Brooklyn, to my house. When they got me home, they gave me a list of all the missing firefighters. I was reading the list and I couldn't believe it. Timmy Stackpole. I was with him when the building came down, but he went to the left. I went to the right. Timmy is gone.
Dan Potter. At the end of the day, 60 friends of mine were killed. So were three very, very close friends. Mike Ricola, Vinnie Giamona, and Brian Hickey.
Sal Cassano, Assistant Chief, FDNY. We lost 343 members. That was 4,400 years of combined experience. We had to rebuild the department from the ground up. We lost our chief of department. We lost our first deputy fire commissioner. We lost two of our most knowledgeable staff chiefs, dozens and dozens of officers. So, how do we rebuild? We had promotions. The next day, I was the chief of operations. Other people were promoted to lieutenant much more quickly than they would have been, captain, battalion chief, deputy chief. We had to rebuild the department, really, from the ground up.
Constance Labetti, accountant, Aon Corporation, South Tower, 99th floor. I had assumed that my boss, Ron Fazio, had gone down ahead of me, being that he was the one that opened the door and hollered to people to hurry. By 8 o'clock in the morning, the phone started ringing. It was my boss, Ron's son, and I immediately started to tell him how much of a hero I thought his dad was. And he was amazing, and he got us all to the staircase. And he said, Connie, where did you see my dad last? I said, he didn't come home. His son said, no, dad hasn't come home. I felt doom at that moment. Aon lost almost 200 employees. The last that was heard of Ron was that he was out of the building. He lent somebody his cell phone as the tower came down. So they think that he might have been hit by the falling debris. He's the reason I'm here. There's no question about it. There's absolutely no question that most of us survived that day because of him.
Lisa Loeffler, employee, Aon Corporation, South Tower, 103rd floor. I called the 800 number posted on the news to advise that I was okay, and so were my coworkers Han, Frank, and Karen. Aeon already had information posted on the website, and someone started a message board on Yahoo for employees. As more people logged on, you started to know more people were okay, or not. There were people posting messages at all hours. I guess no one else could sleep either. That night, we received a very strange phone call at around 11:30, which I answered. The caller expressed surprise and relief to hear it was me. He said his name was Boyd Harden, and he was a rescue worker working at Ground Zero, and that he had found my briefcase. I was stunned. So was he when he asked where I dropped it, and I told him I hadn't dropped it. It was at my desk on 103. For proof that it was mine, he called the number on my resume, which was in the side pocket.
Philip Smith, Branch Chief, U.S. Army, Pentagon. On that day, in our division, we had 20 people. We had 7 killed and 3 injured. We suffered about a 50% loss rate in one day.
Gabriela Diaz Dominguez. There were 11 people in our town that died. It's a commuter train town. The sad part was the cars left in the train parking lot that were never reclaimed.
Charles Kristoff, attorney, Broadway. The next day, I brought Gretchen to the daycare, went into the city, and started looking for Kirsten, from hospital to hospital, because there was no centralized information where you could see the victims. I had to wait in line. The first hospital, every hospital, they gave me a list of various hospitals where she might be, and I was checking. For almost 2 weeks, every day, that was my routine.
Michael Amonico, executive chef, Windows on the World, North Tower, 106th floor. It took days and days to compile the list of the missing. They weren't gone, they were unaccounted for. Someone had to have gotten down those stairs. They were going to pull people out of the rubble, like in devastating earthquakes, how people get pulled out 5 days later. I believed that until the end of the week, until Sunday or Monday. We lost 72 people that worked at WOW.
Joe Asher, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower. I remember the day of the death certificates. People needed them to begin taking care of their spouse's estate. The city set up a system where a death certificate could be obtained with an affidavit from the next of kin and an affidavit from the employer. The employer's affidavit said essentially name, social security number, date of birth, etc., worked for Cantor Fitzgerald at One World Trade Center, and to the best of our knowledge, was in the building on September 11. We did individual affidavits. The stack was a foot high. Each was 2 pages. Stephen Merkel, our general counsel, sits down to start signing, and for each one, he would look at it. And if he knew the person, he would say something about the person. This went on for hours. It was just awful.
Dr. Charles Hirsch. We were ready to start receiving the dead on 9/11. It went pretty much as we had planned. The only major difference from the standpoint of our agency is that in spite of all the planning, we had never conceived of a situation in which hundreds or thousands of people would be fragmented. We had no specific contingency plan for a mass disaster in which DNA would be the major source of identification.
Donna Pierce, resident, Manhattan. The city was plastered with missing persons flyers. No one wanted to be alone.
Katie Couric. The most emotionally searing time was the days following, with all the signs and the Xeroxed pictures affixed to the chain-link fences. There was so much desperation to find people.
On Capitol Hill, legislators and staff began to plan the nation's response and recovery efforts, even as they now realized their own offices might be a future terrorist target.
Senator Tom Daschle, I look back on September 12th as, in some ways, the best and the worst of our country. The best part was how resilient our country can be in the tragedies of this magnitude. The worst had to do with the vulnerability and loss of so many lives and the knowledge that there was agony and so much pain.
Brian Gunderson. As we came back to work to the Capitol on the morning of the 12th, there were a lot of changes. There were new security barriers that were thrown up. There were military Humvees with 50-caliber machine guns on top, with soldiers manning them. At a glance, it looked like there had been a coup.
Tish Schwartz. It was really somber. The staff, everybody had a story. Everybody had a friend who was affected by the attack. Somebody who knew somebody that died either in New York or the Pentagon.
Brian Gunderson. During that week, there were occasional new security alarms. There was one moment, I think it was that first week, where the Capitol had to be evacuated again. It happened by surprise, no warning. All of a sudden, the alarms went off, people had to get out. It was a very jittery environment.
Steve Elmendorf. This had never been a place you had to come to work before that you had to worry.
Mary Beth Cahill, Chief of Staff for Senator Edward Kennedy. When I first came to Washington, you could walk up to the Capitol, to every monument. You could walk in to talk to your representative without having your bag searched. Now, we take for granted the way in which life has changed, and changed necessarily. It was a different world.
In Pennsylvania, on Wednesday, September 12th, investigators began sifting through the wreckage of Flight 93, looking for clues in the case that the FBI would call Pent Bomb, for Pentagon Twin Towers Bombing Investigation. For weeks afterward, the quiet town of Shanksville was the center of a 24/7 operation, broadcast live by hundreds of media outlets from across the globe.
Patrick McGlennon, Special Agent FBI. The 12th was the actual first operational day when the full-scale investigation began. Things started to move in the direction of bringing in our evidence response teams, overflying the area, mapping it out, determining how large the scene actually was, and how many people we were going to need in there to effectively search it, document what was being found, and coordinate the overall effort. All the same sorts of things that you would do at any crime scene.
Corporal Martin Knezovich, Special Emergency Response Team, Pennsylvania State Police. I was back out at 7 the next morning. We were given specific areas to search these areas for any type of debris, parts from the plane, or anything we could find dealing with the crash.
Sergeant Patrick Madigan, Commander Somerset Station, Pennsylvania State Police. There were several impromptu memorials that sprung up in the days ahead. One was at the media area. PennDOT, Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, erected two large flagpoles, and we put the state flag and the national flag there. A number of people left some mementos there. At the Overlook, there was another memorial type of thing. There were hay bales there, and family members left a lot of personal mementos.
Lieutenant Robert Weaver, Pennsylvania State Police. Everywhere you looked, there were flags.
Thursday. On September 13th, the engine of America's economy began to chug back to life, and air traffic controllers, under strict security, began restarting air travel.
Gerald Earwood, pilot, Midwest Express, Flight 7. I was captain of the first aircraft to leave New York. I had to perform an inspection around the aircraft, a bomb inspection with local law enforcement and the FBI observing everything I did. I would open up a panel, read the checklist, look into the hole, step back, and three more people would do the exact same thing. It probably took about 30 minutes to do something that usually takes 5 or 10 minutes. We loaded everyone up. We started to push back. The ground controller called and said, "We hate to tell you this, but there has been a bomb threat against your aircraft. You need to evacuate." So I picked up the PA and said, "You aren't going to believe this, but we have a bomb threat and we have to evacuate." Everyone calmly evacuated the aircraft and walked out onto the runway. At that moment, one of our military aircraft flew over, and that got our attention. When we got back on the aircraft and we were taxiing out, our friends from the military made another pass as we were leaving. I told my first officer, "I hope the military knows we are coming."
I remember the missiles stuck on the bottom of the wings. I called and asked the tower, "Confirm with us that the military knows that we're about to be airborne here." He came back and said, "Yeah, they know you're coming." They sent us right over the World Trade Center. It was moving.
Jared Coates. On Thursday, I did get back to my office in Lower Manhattan, and I remember these empty desks. The telephones ringing all day long, people were calling, hoping and hoping against hope. Or maybe they wanted to hear their daughter or their loved one's voice, and that was the only way they could hear it, to listen to the phone message. I never picked up the phones. I didn't know what to tell people.
Monica Bravo, artist, North Tower, 91st floor. I tried to get in touch with everybody who was part of our studioscape program on the 91st floor of the North Tower, the other 15 fellow artists and the curators. I remember saying, "Why don't we try to meet in 2 or 3 days so we can comfort each other?" The whole world was going crazy and everybody was coming to terms with what's going on. This first meeting happened Thursday. At one point in this meeting, I remembered I had the tape. Oh my God, I saved the tape that I made of the storm on 9/10. I had learned with practice that to process very deep emotions, you have to transform them into something. That's why I'm an artist. So I decided to transform the tape into something and give it to everybody. It's a very, very eerie video. I don't want to say it's premonitory, but if you see it from that perspective, it's like, wow. I actually named the video September 10th, 2001, Uno nunca muere la víspera. It is a saying in Spanish. It's impossible for you to die on the eve of your death. You only die when you have to die. You're never close to death. You die, or you're alive.
Friday. September 14th saw more steps back to normalcy. President Bush journeyed to New York City, to Ground Zero, where he stood atop the wreckage and spoke to rescuers using a bullhorn.
Dan Bartlett, Deputy Communications Director, White House. The real change in the president, in my opinion, didn't actually happen until that Friday when he traveled to New York. The situation on Tuesday, you really didn't have time to reflect. In New York, the range of emotions that he went through, standing on the rubble, the bullhorn moment, but just as important when he sat there in that room in private and met with those people who were still trying to learn the whereabouts of their loved ones and hugging them.
Robert Beckwith. Retired firefighter, FDNY. We kept working, and all of a sudden, we heard the president was coming. I saw a couple of guys put the shovels down and go out to the street. So I went out to the street. I see this pumper that we found. It was 76 engine, and nobody was standing on it. So I jumped up. Right across the street was a command post. It was a tent with microphones all set up in front of it. The president came right in front of me. He put his arm up, and I grabbed his arm. I pulled him up. He's only got a little spot, a 12-inch by 12-inch. And I turned him around, and I said, "You okay, Mr. President?" And he said, "Yeah." And then he put his arm around my shoulder. And there he was with the megaphone, and he was talking and talking to a right side. And the guys on the other side, on the left side, were yelling, "USA, USA." Then they stopped, and they said, "We can't hear you." He turned and he said, "Well, I can hear you. The whole world hears you. And when we find these people who knocked these buildings down, they'll hear all of us soon." Everybody melted.
Lieutenant Colonel Rob Grunewald. Friday, to me, was mental anguish. Our office was having a muster formation at the AMC movie theater nearby. We were going to get together, and the senior leaders of the army were going to come talk to us. Everyone who was physically capable was going to go. To see all the wounded and injured people, it was horrible. People with their arms bandaged, people on crutches, people in wheelchairs, people with burns to their scalps. A friend of mine, Ann Parham, the army librarian, just had her head wrapped up, bandaged on her ears that had burned. It was a terrible, terrible thing to see. We got into the movie theater and what was left of the leadership because the plane came in and took out the senior leaders of the Army Personnel Office known as G1, including General Maud. His wife, Terry Maud, got up and gave a speech. It was remarkable. We were all blabbering and blubbering idiots, and she was strong as strong could be. That was why that day was the hardest. Because not only were you seeing all these badly burned and broken bodies, but every few minutes you would hear of another person who was unaccounted for. Another person who was confirmed deceased, another person who was in the hospital badly burned. It was very, very difficult to get your hands around what was going on and the magnitude of this.
Linda Crooner. That Friday was my birthday. There's a woman from my firm, Carmen Rivera, who was my trust officer on many accounts, and so I spoke to her a lot. She had a young family, and she was one of these beautiful younger women. She had the most engaging smile. My daughter wanted to give me a birthday present by locating Carmen Rivera and telling me that she was alive. She looked through different websites with her friends, but they searched and searched, and they didn't find her.
Allie Millard, whose stepfather, Port Authority Executive Director Neil Levin, was killed in the attack. The Friday after September 11, there was a candlelight vigil, and a bunch of friends of mine were sitting on the sidewalk. My friend Lonnie said, "Allie, don't think of it as you losing a person. Think of it as you gaining an angel. I don't really believe in angels or the afterlife. But the way I interpreted what Lonnie said was that people are only put on Earth for a certain amount of time. And you're lucky to get to know them for as long as you do."
Saturday.
Lisa Jefferson, Verizon Airphone Supervisor. I was concerned because United Flight 93 passenger Todd Beamer wanted me to call his wife and relay the information to her. I didn't know how to call her, and how would I tell her this, being a stranger? It didn't sound right by me to call her and say, "Hello, Lisa, this is Lisa. I spoke to your husband." I talked to the FBI, and they told me not to mention anything, not to contact her until they finished their investigation. I told them I wouldn't. All the while I was thinking, how would I contact her? What would I say? The FBI got back in touch with me on Friday and told me that I could call her. We contacted the United Airlines crisis team member who was in contact with Lisa Beamer and told him that when she was ready to talk, she could call me at home or at work. We faxed the letter over to United on Friday evening. My phone rang at about 10 a.m. Saturday morning. It was Lisa. She said, "I understand you spoke to my husband." I totally froze. I didn't expect her to call. I wasn't thinking about it at that time. I said, "Yes." And I said, "Are you ready to talk?" She said, "Yes." We sat and we talked. I told her everything her husband told me to tell her.
Lisa Beamer, wife of United Flight 93 passenger Todd Beamer. As much as, obviously, 9/11 was traumatic for people like myself, for someone like Lisa, it was also a life-changing event. We keep in touch periodically to catch up and see how we're doing. We probably will continue to do that. The first couple of days after 9/11, not knowing the facts around what had happened on that flight, not knowing what Todd's role was difficult. Having all that concrete information from Lisa, as well as Todd's final message to us, was a great encouragement.
Mary Detloff. I remember my partner and I watched nothing but CNN for days until I couldn't take it anymore. I finally broke away on a Saturday and went for a walk in a nature area near Jackson, Michigan. I remember a plane flew overhead while I was out there, and I just stopped and watched it. I did that for a long time after 9/11. Watched the planes fly over our house.
Admiral James Loy, Commandant, U.S. Coast Guard. Maybe the fourth or fifth day, it dawned on me that the church at the end of Wall Street, Trinity Church, was within spitting distance of the tower site and was part of the rest of the city that was deluged in debris. I sat in my office for a second and said, Alexander Hamilton is buried in that cemetery. He's considered the founder of the modern-day Coast Guard because he established its predecessor, the Revenue Cutter Service. I couldn't stand the notion that he and his headstone were probably inundated with debris. I called Master Chief Vince Patton into the office, and I said, Vince, I need you to get some senior enlisted folks from the captain of the Port of New York's office. I know they're up to their ass in alligators right now, but we've got to go fix that. He got a senior chief in New York on the phone. They went and began the cleanup of the entire Trinity Churchyard. The word got out to the Trade Center site. And people, after finishing their unbelievably difficult work for a 12-hour cycle, came over and joined with these Coast Guard people to finish the job. I was damned if I could go to sleep that night without doing something about it.
Sunday.
Tracy Donahue. The mayor had said for people to resume their lives, start shopping, and support New York City. The Sunday after, I remember working on Fulton Street again. People were coming down and they said, oh, I want to go shopping at Century 21. I would say, there is no Century 21 right now. They said, oh, but the mayor said we can go shopping. There's no Century 21 at this point. There's no Brooks Brothers. There's nothing at that area. He means go to 34th Street, shop there, and have a nice lunch.
On Sunday, September 16th, President Bush spoke to the press after a weekend War Council meeting at Camp David. He noted the resiliency of the American spirit and that the New York Stock Exchange would reopen Monday after its first prolonged closure since the Great Depression. The coming weeks. For nearly 2 weeks, the rescue effort at Ground Zero continued around the clock as firefighters, police officers, rescue workers, other first responders, and skilled tradesmen hunted for signs of the missing. Finally, on September 24th, Mayor Giuliani announced there was no further hope of survivors.
Captain Joe Downey, Squad Company 18, FDNY, and son of Ray Downey, FDNY Head of Special Operations. Chuck Downey, my brother and I, we didn't leave the site for the first 5 or 6 days. We stayed there. We slept on the floors. We slept wherever we could find a bunk. We wanted to be there in case we did find him.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross, Engine 16, FDNY. September 15th or something like that was my first night here. When I saw the site, it was at night. I saw the red glow, the smoke, and it was pouring rain. It felt like I was going into hell. I said, oh geez, maybe I made a big mistake coming here. After a few hours, it was a job again. We were looking for people and I was back to work. From that point, I got better. I came back to reality.
Detective David Brink, Emergency Service Unit Truck 3, NYPD. We would go down there with either steel rakes, we'd go down with shovels. We had plastic 5-gallon buckets that we were using to remove some of the debris. We'd also have little shovels and hand picks because oftentimes the only body fragments that we'd find were very, very small.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. It was very long hours. It was cold. It was very demanding. When we first got here, there was no setup for food or shelter. They didn't even have coffee. We were out in the rain all night, soaking wet. Eventually, they got it together and became better and better. The Red Cross came. They opened up the big tent and they had cots, and St. Paul's Church opened up and they had food.
Joe Esposito. If you were on the outside, you were wearing a heavy coat. If you were handling the bucket brigade, we circulated people closer and closer. As you got closer and closer and closer to this pit that you were taking pails out full of debris, it got warmer and warmer. When you were ultimately the first guy in there, you were in your t-shirt because it was on fire. It was like you were in an oven.
Sergeant Joe Allegna, aide to the chief, NYPD. You didn't even realize how dangerous it was. They would dig down, and there'd be a void, and you could see the beams glowing.
They were still on fire, and we were standing on top of it. It was tedious, hard work, and nobody complained.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. They became my new family, the people that worked there. The firefighters, the police officers, the volunteers.
Detective David Brink. The fire department would take a sector, the NYPD Emergency Service Unit would take another sector, along with Port Authority and the Corrections Emergency Service Units. We also had the construction trades that were down there. Heavy equipment operators, the operating engineers, the steel guys. I was very thankful for those guys because they had the heavy equipment that could help us do our jobs.
Norma Hardy, officer, PATH Command, PAPD. It always seemed dark, even when it was daytime. You did whatever had to be done when you got there. Even though there were hundreds and hundreds of people, machines, people talking, and rescue dogs, it still seemed very quiet and very still a lot of nights that we were out there.
Bill Spade, firefighter, Rescue 5, FDNY. Then the funerals started. You would go to a wake for either 1 or 2 days, and then the funeral. Everybody had a job, whether you were a pallbearer, gave a eulogy, or just stood in formation outside the church. It was very draining. With my injuries, I could hardly stand, but I stood for every one out of respect. On days when I wasn't going for guys in my firehouse, I was going for other firemen. Whoever was on Staten Island being buried, go to their wake or funeral. I tried to do even 2 a days sometimes. That became my life, besides seeing the doctors on the other days, for 3 months. I remember looking over the list of the 343 firemen and realizing that I knew 85 of them by first name.
Kenneth Escoffery. It was a wake one day, a funeral the next day, every week. Just for the 14 guys that responded from my house, that was more than enough. I would say that the average fireman probably went to 25, 30 funerals, not even counting the wakes. It got to the point where a lot of guys got burnt out. After a month or two, you had to shut down.
Tracy Claus, wife of Cantor Fitzgerald survivor Matt Claus. There were days we went to 4 funerals and could have gone to 6. Matt didn't sleep for a long while, so I didn't sleep. I had a 2.5-year-old at the time. From the chaos that was in our house, my daughter started to stutter. She started having nightmares. She said, "Daddy works in buildings that fall down."
Anthony R. Whitaker, WTC Commander, PAPD, North Tower Lobby. 4 days a week, I used to stand in front of Banana Republic at the World Trade Center, probably for half an hour, between 8:30 a.m. and 9 a.m. I greeted people every morning, 4 days a week for 28 months, thousands of people. One thing that really bothers me is that I don't know what happened to all those many faces that I used to wave at. In the daily news, they ran spreads of photographs. One of the things that hurt me was that I recognized almost 80% of those people.
Thomas Von Essen, Commissioner, FDNY. The emptiness from the losses that day has never left me. Not for a moment.
Similar rescue and recovery efforts continued at the Pentagon. The fire and collapse so damaged the impact zone that it took expert urban search and rescue teams days of extensive, painstaking work to shore up the area before interior searches could resume. The Arlington County Fire Department didn't turn over control of the site to the FBI until September 21st, and the FBI spent more than a week searching and securing the scene before returning it to the military's control on October 2nd.
Thomas O'Connor, Special Agent, FBI. We didn't actually get into the building for several days. Chief James Schwartz and the firefighters were in charge of the entire event. The firefighting going on inside the building went on for a lot longer than people realize. The urban search and rescue teams were the ones that were shoring up the building to a point where we could go in, and then we would do recoveries.
Gene O'Connor, Special Agent, FBI. The first time I went in, I literally had a rope tied around my waist so I would be able to find my way back out of the building, because the debris piles were so high and there was no pattern necessarily, no logical pattern.
James Schwartz. The arrangement was that you reported for duty at our training academy, and we bust you to the incident scene. Then at the end of your work period, you were taken back to the training academy. What we didn't account for was, in a similar vein to New York, people didn't want to go home. People would go back to the training academy, get dropped off by the bus, get in their personal vehicle, and drive back to the Pentagon. They'd get right back in and go right back to work.
Staff Sergeant Robert Walker, Special Agent, Office of Special Investigations, U.S. Air Force. That first week, we were there 14 16-hour days. Long enough to go home, strip off the jeans and stuff we had, grab a couple hours sleep, and come back.
Thomas O'Connor. We were pretty new to our neighborhood there, maybe a year or so. It was amazing. People were bringing food over. At first, we said, we don't really need anything. But when you have 3 hours to get home, shower, wash your clothes, get to sleep, get back up, get dressed, go. Then when somebody brings over a sleeve of hamburgers, it made a huge difference. Somebody took our dog for almost the whole month that we were there. Kids were coming by, walking the dog, small things like that that really made a difference.
Staff Sergeant Robert Walker. The debris and such was loaded into these long dumpsters and then taken to the north parking lot, which we called the rubble pit, the rubble pile. The trucks would come and they would spread out this debris. They had cadaver dogs go over them, and if there were any remains in the rubble, they would photograph it, tag it, identify it, evidence, and have it taken over to the makeshift morgue that we had set up at the Pentagon. From there, we led some teams to go through the pile. We were actually separating. Was it equipment like telephones, computer systems? Was it personal items, personal equipment? Was it classified information, personal books? Was it airplane parts? It was very labor-intensive.
Lieutenant Jim Daly. I remember going home and my wife coming up and asking me how things were. I said, well, I found a femur bone and found a bunch of other personal belongings. I remember my son coming up because I'd put him to bed. He was 5 and he heard the word bones. And he said, Daddy, are there bones in that plane? I said, there were chickens. Chicken bones in that plane. He looked at me with a real quizzical look and he asked, there were chickens on that plane?
John F. Irby, Director, Federal Facilities Division, Real Estate and Facilities Directorate, Washington Headquarters Services, Pentagon. It took a month before we got back to what we could call reasonably normal. That was more redefining normal than getting back to normal.
Philip Smith, Branch Chief, U.S. Army, Pentagon. For a long time in the Pentagon, the smells of the fire were there to remind you of what had occurred.
Sheila Denise Moody. It's still to this day and will forever be a miracle to me that I'm still alive. I was in the hospital up until October 4th. I had skin grafts on my hands, but the rest of my body pretty much healed fairly well. I still have pretty severe burns, scars on my arms and on my back. But amazingly enough, my face healed pretty well.
In Pennsylvania, investigators worked tirelessly, often feeling that their efforts were overlooked by the nation.
David Zacker, Special Agent, FBI. For the next 3 weeks at the crash site, they brought in excavators. They started to dig it out.
Tony James, Investigator, FAA. We found the cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder somewhere around 25 or 27 feet. We stopped digging, I think, at 32 feet. We never did find what the FBI was actually looking for, the cockpit. That had disintegrated.
Andrea Damon.